Good morning and welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. That means our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And just have a short quote for our lighting of the candle from Catherine Spence. Nothing is insignificant in the history of a young country, and above all, nothing seems impossible. I've been doing this gig for over 20 years, which I sometimes call famous women we've never heard of, and I'm still surprised, though, to discover people that I have never heard of, and I don't know that anyone here ever had either, Catherine Spence. Now, that's because she's from Australia. If we lived there, we would probably know her as sort of the equivalent of Susan B. Anthony, except that she was in many more spheres, which we will hear about. She worked for greater democracy, women's suffrage, social programs for children, the elderly, and the poor. She wrote several novels and dozens, maybe hundreds, of newspaper articles. She's even been on the money in Australia. And it's interesting to compare Australia and the United States since both were still very new in the 19th century. Today I'll tell you about the life and work of this energetic woman. Catherine Spence was born in 1825 in Scotland, the fifth of eight children. She said that she had a happy childhood, enjoying the surroundings which Walter Scott memorialized. She was fortunate to attend school with an excellent head teacher from age 4 to 13. Her brothers, of course, went to a boys' school, and many girls did not get a very good education. She was very happy with the teacher she had. She does mention that 2 hours of the day were devoted to sewing. Fortunately, the teachers would read aloud from biography, history, and other works while the girls were sewing, so their education was still furthered. The family was very involved in the local Calvinist church, attending two services every Sunday. Catherine wrote in her autobiography, "The only cloud on my young life was the gloomy religion, which made me doubt of my own salvation and despair of the salvation of any but a very small proportion of the people in the world." And I don't know whether the Calvinists were the ones with predestination that said, you're already doomed or saved. Yeah. Thus, the character of God appeared unlovely, and it was wicked not to love God, and this was my condemnation. So how could she love this cruel being? And I like this idea. There was no getting away from the feeling that the world was under a curse ever since that unlucky apple eating in the Garden of Eden. Why, oh why, had not the sentence of death been carried out at once and a new start made with more prudent people? So why didn't God just say, oh, back to the drawing board, just get rid of Adam and Eve and let's create some new people and start over, instead of condemning them to centuries of misery? And I got this from her autobiography. I was not able to find any books in this country, biographies of Catherine Spence online. There's information in Wikipedia and so on and other sources. There were some books in Australia, but because I started this even a couple months ago, it would have taken too long to get the books. So I'll have to look into that. But her autobiography is in public domain, so it can be read either online or if you have Kindle or another platform, it should be free to download her autobiography and also some of her novels and other works. Catherine's father was a banker and a lawyer, and they were well off enough to have three servants, a housemaid, a nursemaid, and a cook. A great thrill that she writes about of her childhood was having gaslighting come to the town. But Mr. Spence made some bad investments and lost most of his money. The family decided to emigrate to Australia, where land was available cheap. Catherine was 13 when they ventured halfway around the world. Catherine's grandmother gave the family £500 towards their new start. They traveled as intermediate passengers, so that meant they had some kind of rough cabin rather than the open bay of steerage, but the food and amenities on the ship were not much better. As was the case in America, land companies advertised in glowing terms the fertile paradise open to new settlers. But as happens sometimes in America, when the Spence family arrived, New South Wales was in the middle of several years of drought. After the beauties of green Scotland, Catherine wrote, "When I saw the place at which we were to land, I felt inclined to go and cut my throat. When we sat down on a log in Light Square, in spite of the dignity of my 14 years just attained, I had a good cry." So she turned 14 while they were on the ship. Catherine's father got the position of town clerk, but that ended after 3 years when the governance of the area was reconfigured. Catherine's older brothers had started farming, but their endeavors failed as well. Catherine wrote, "My father lost his health and spirits." And she writes a lot, both in Scotland, where they supposedly had money, and here about how much various things cost at the time. That was very important to the family, apparently. Now, Catherine had a glowing letter of recommendation from her former teacher, but even in Australia, 14 was very young for her to get a job. She taught her younger siblings, but she was hampered by the scarcity of books in the colony. And she was personally very frustrated by this. She read over and over the few books they had been able to bring, because of course they could not bring a lot of property with them on the ship. At 17, she began to work as a governess several hours a day for three different families. Excuse me. She had also started submitting poems and essays to local newspapers, many of which were printed. Catherine wrote in her autobiography, "It is always supposed that thoughts of love and marriage are the chief concerns in a girl's life, but it was not the case with me. I had only two offers of marriage in my life, and I refused both. The first might have been accepted if it had not been for the Calvinistic creed that made me shrink from the possibility of bringing children into the world with so little chance of eternal salvation." So her religion had scared her so much that she said, "What if I have children and they're doomed to hell?" So I said no to a very clever young man with whom I had argued on many points, and with whom, if I had married him, I should have argued till one of us died. So maybe that would have worked out. However, I was 17 and had just begun to earn money. I told him why I had refused him and that it was final. In 6 weeks, he was engaged to another woman. My second offer was made to me when I was 23 by a man aged 55 with three children. So he obviously wanted a free nanny. "But if the number of lovers has been few, no woman in Australia has been richer in friends." And she did state at other times that this freedom that she had as a single woman allowed her to do many of the things that she accomplished. In 1854, so that is when she was 29, Catherine published her first novel, Clara Morrison, A Tale of South Australia, during the gold fever. Because there was a gold rush in Australia, just like in Alaska and parts of the US, California. Catherine had already been writing articles and essays for newspapers for some time. So she was the first woman to write a novel set in Australia, and actually the first person to write a novel set in contemporary Australia. And it was published in England as well. It was followed by another book called Tender and True about relationships within marriage, which was even more successful. Catherine didn't make much money from them, but their reception encouraged her. In 1855, at the age of 30, Catherine became involved in a long-term campaign for what was called the Hare System, H-A-R-E, after a man in England who had devised this. Of course, most of us have never heard of it, so I looked into it. There were a couple of elements. One was a system we now know of as ranked choice, that you could have votes for multiple candidates in case your first choice was eliminated. It also backed what they called proportional representation. This meant the number of voters for parties should be reflected in the results rather than a winner-take-all system. So for example, if Wisconsin is divided 50-50 between the two main parties, our state legislature should be divided in the same proportion. Of course, Australia had a multi-party parliamentary system based on Britain, which makes this kind of representation easier. But Catherine wrote letters to newspapers for years about these electoral reforms. Her brother coined a very useful term. He called it effective voting. So that's often, having a good tagline or a good name for your program can really help. And she also published pamphlets on the issue. On a trip around this time to England and Scotland, Catherine was able to meet many famous literary and political figures and visit her old home. It was on this trip that she first attended Unitarian services. She had decided some years earlier that she didn't still believe in the frightening tenets of her upbringing, but at this time she wrote, "I became a convinced Unitarian, and the cloud was lifted from the universe. I think I have been a most cheerful person ever since." Catherine's next novel, which was eventually called Mr. Hogarth's Will, took up, as she said, the woman question, the difficulty of a woman earning a livelihood, even when she had as much ability, industry, and perseverance as a man. Catherine herself was extremely competent in discussing economics and agronomy. She was very involved in family businesses and farming. Yet women were practically forbidden to speak in public. Catherine wrote, "My development as a public speaker was more important than the publication of a fourth novel. Much had been written on the subject of public speaking by men, but so far nothing concerning the capacities of women in that direction. And yet I think all teachers will agree that girls in the aggregate excel boys in their powers of expression, whether in writing or in speech. Yet law and custom have put a bridle on the tongue of women, and of the innumerable proverbs relating to the sex, the most cynical are those relating to her use of language." And then she goes on to say, "When I returned from my first visit to England in 1866, I was asked by the committee of the South Australian Institute to write a lecture on my impressions of England, but neither the committee nor myself thought of the possibility of my delivering it. I did not go to hear it, but I was told that he had difficulty in reading my manuscript and that it was not very satisfactory. So I mentally resolved that if I was again asked, I should offer to read my own manuscript." When she actually did this for the first time, she said, "I felt very nervous and as if my knees were giving way, but I did not show any nervousness. Not having had any lessons in elocution, I trusted to my natural voice and felt that in this new role, the less gesticulation I used, the better. So at this time, people would do recitations and elocution in a very formal, dramatic way with large gestures." And she spoke as herself, and it was effective. She hadn't had that stage training. Around this time, Catherine got involved in another cause, dealing with orphans. She was very active in an organization that worked to place orphans in families and to regularly inspect those families to be sure the children were treated well. And I thought it's possible that orphans were more of a problem in the new land of Australia because there were few extended family members to take them in. So if the parents died, the family had probably just come there as a small unit. This group was eventually able to close an orphanage of over 200 children by finding them all homes. And for juvenile offenders, the group recommended a special children's court and system of probation rather than harsher punishments. Catherine was the first woman in Australia appointed to a board of education, and she lobbied successfully for free public education, which was not the norm at the time in Australia or Britain. There were school fees that were keeping some people away. She wrote a curriculum for children of 10 to 12 years old on what we would now call civics, about government. She advocated for women to get university degrees. She regretted this hadn't been possible for her. And she thought women should become doctors and lawyers. In fields where women were working, such as teaching, she argued for equal pay. Personally, she subsidized and supported a number of children through their schooling, recommending reading, helping them find employment, generally being a mentor, we would say now. Catherine was a regular contributor to newspapers and magazines, continuing to write about improvements that would democratize the new country. And she also spoke regularly on literary topics. She was very interested in the whole Shakespeare and Bacon controversy, which was a big thing at the time. She even created a book of word puzzles. She published anonymously a book called An Agnostic's Progress. This was not modeled on the famous book by John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress, which by allegory shows a Christian's journey in life. But her subtitle was From the Known to the Unknown. That is, rather than coming to some unshaken faith, the explorer called Questor, Q-U-A-E-S-T-O-R, he learns there is no one truth. In her autobiography some years later, Catherine admitted to being that anonymous author, stating, "The doctrine of innate human depravity is one of the most paralyzing dogmas that human fear invented or priestcraft encouraged." That is the idea of original sin and humans being bad from the get-go. She said, "I wrote this to relieve my own mind. I wanted to satisfy myself that reverent agnostics were by no means materialists, that man's nature might or might not be consciously immortal, but it was spiritual, that in the duties which lay before each of us towards ourselves and towards our fellow creatures, there was scope for spiritual energy and spiritual emotion." So this is like this good without God idea, right? That this was quite ahead of her time, though. In her 60s, Catherine was still very active. She crisscrossed her adopted country, lobbying for the electoral reforms that she had been supporting. In 1893, at 68 years old, she toured America and Canada. She spoke at many Unitarian churches and at the Chicago's World's Fair. The 1893 was a big exposition there. And she returned by way of England, France, Italy, and Germany. So she actually went around the world on this trip. She returned to find that women's suffrage had been won in her territory of New South Wales, one of the first places in the world. In 1897, at 72 years old, she ran for office as Australia's first woman candidate for the Federal Constitutional Convention. Although she didn't win, she did garner 7,500 votes. The next year, Spence published a book called A Week in the Future, which is also available through Gutenberg. The narrator, an elderly woman, gives up her remaining lifetime in order to visit the next century for 1 week. After drinking an elixir, she travels from 1898 to 1998. The society she finds in England, where the book is set, is a socialist, communitarian one, modeled on the ideas of Robert Owen. People live in complexes, much like our current-day co-housing. They have a room or two of their own, but the living and dining spaces are shared. There are servants, but they are well paid. Someone said in the 19th century, pretty much you either had a servant or were a servant because there were no labor-saving devices and the amount of work needed to keep things going was so excessive. The economy is organized so that in this future, that cooperatives produce almost everything needed within the country. International trade and tariffs are minimal. Middlemen and advertising have been removed. And conspicuous consumption doesn't exist. People only need a few clothes, a certain amount of food, and so on. Trades are valued as highly as professions, and children learn handcrafts and practical skills along with academics. There is full employment, and everyone only needs to work 6 hours a day, using their other time for arts, hobbies, helping children, and so on. Schooling is compulsory and free. Medical services are free, but they're little needed because everyone has such a healthy lifestyle. In a throwaway section, we learn that the population is controlled by, quote, idiot infants being destroyed. So we've seen this before. The progressive and scientific leaders at the turn of the 20th century were often supporters of eugenics. They felt that breeding methods that worked for animals should be the scientific way to help humanity. And in this utopia, even religions have become rational, and they no longer impose ridiculous fears, beliefs, and practices on their followers. So yes, it's called A Week in the Future, and it's not very long. You can find it online. This vision was undoubtedly created in reaction to situations Catherine had seen herself in her work with orphans, the elderly, and the poor. At age 75, she helped establish a women's cooperative clothing company. She also helped start a scholarship fund so that poor children could complete higher education. As for her beloved crusade for effective voting, she helped run a trial program in Tasmania, although the actual adoption of the reform didn't happen until shortly after her death. And she wrote her autobiography when she was around 80 years old. When Spence died on April 3rd, 1910, at the age of 84, she was lauded as the grand old woman of Australia. She had seen the country develop from a wilderness to a functioning state. And in everything I read by her, of her autobiography and essays, I saw absolutely zero mention of the indigenous people who were displaced by these glorious British settlements. Now, possibly in her novel, she may have something about that, but that was interesting that there was a lot of glorification of how they had developed this empty land. In Adelaide, a bronze statue of Spence was dedicated in 1986, and a wing of the State Library of South Australia was named for her in 2003. Spence's portrait appeared on Australian $5 banknotes between 2001 and 2016. Since 1912, the South Australian government has offered the Catherine Helen Spence Memorial Scholarship, which is awarded every 4 years to a woman studying social problems in Australia and abroad. Thus, her memory is maintained in her adopted home country, but it should be better known to those of us around the world. Well, the reason she didn't get any more education is because her family moved to Australia when she was 13, and nothing was really set up there. But there probably wasn't higher education for girls either. That is, that was actually more than many girls got, I believe, to be able to go up to the age of 13. She was a big reader, and her family seemed to encourage learning in general. But yes, boys, of course, went through school and even universities. And I don't know the history of Australian education, whether schools did get set up that were coeducational to high school at that time or not. She certainly published a lot of these articles, and it doesn't seem like she was getting a lot of hostility. It took some time to, she did have some things about how politicians were wary of doing something that would not immediately benefit them, which we can identify with today, making changes like this. There wasn't reporting of the fact that when she began to speak in public, she didn't have people throwing things at her or shouting her down, which sometimes happened with the suffragists in the U.S. I have read some books by Neville Shute, who is most famous for On the Beach, which is a rather depressing book. Most of his books are very positive, and one of them is about, after the war, how there was a whole campaign for Australia to get refugees, for instance, from Europe to come there, and they called them, instead of immigrants, they called them New Australians. And in this one book, he makes it sound very positive, like everyone was welcoming, which I'm sure was not always the case. And I think that in recent years, there's been issues about migrants from Africa from Southeast Asia who are being held on islands offshore and not treated well. So it's not a haven necessarily. But there is, I think there is some sense of Australia being sort of like the American West, you know, wide open and these big, huge ranches and very independent and individualistic in some ways because people were so isolated, and definitely the idea of getting rid of the indigenous people or putting them to school to learn to be good servants, all the things that, some of the things we did here. And yes, and it was, and nobody necessarily knew after a while whether your family came as a convict or as a pioneer. Yeah, it was very interesting to see what she, you know, what she thought it would be like and how this would work, and that people would accept this egalitarian idea. You know, we don't need a lot of stuff, and we don't need to have more than somebody else. Well, we're all community. And yeah, it's but I think she has, as a visitor there, she remarks on that. There's no advertising here. It seems so dull. And our brief closing words from Catherine Spence: words have the power to change the world.